Jill Lepore teaches American history at Harvard and writes for The New Yorker. She says that the Founding Fathers are a hot commodity for Democrats and Republicans alike. In her new book, The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History, Lepore does a reality check on Tea Party claims to the Founding Fathers. She told Anne Strainchamps about the moment they entered the Tea Party picture.
Well, if you remember, Barack Obama was inaugurated in January of 2009, and just a few weeks later, cable news financial reporter Rick Santelli delivered what came to be called, within hours, and sort of went viral on the internet, the rant around the world. He was delivering a really early morning broadcast from the floor of Chicago Stock Exchange and kind of lost it talking about the stimulus package and the bailout. And there was a very kind of strange crowd behind him of brokers kind of getting ready to start their work day. And people started cheering as he kind of ranted on and on and on about how un-American it was and that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were rolling over in their graves at the idea that the government would pay your neighbor's mortgage. Or, you know, there's this kind of weird conflation of what the stimulus package even did. Or just generally the economic policies of the latter end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration. And Santelli called for Americans to, he said, we could dump tea into Lake Michigan here in Chicago. We need a new tea party.
When it comes to the Founding Fathers and the original Boston Tea Party and the politics of the 1770s, there's not much that you don't know. And as an historian, this is your field. You know, just to run through a few of the Tea Party's claims, a major Tea Party analogy has been this idea of taxation without representation. How does that actually hold up?
So that's a slogan that dates really from 1765, when the British Parliament imposed the Stamp Act on American colonies, a new sort of stamp tax. And Boston colonists in particular wrote eloquently about the need for the colonists to be represented in Parliament in order for Parliament to levy this kind of tax. There had been taxes before, but this was a different kind of tax. And so that is an important claim in the 18th century, and it is a big part of how American colonists who later, you know, fight for independence think about the nature of their struggle. How that has anything to do with the Tea Party's claim in 2009 that, say, healthcare reform was a violation of the principles of the American Revolution is hard to say, given that voter turnout in the election in 2008, for instance, was higher than in any American presidential election since 1968. So there it was a great deal of political representation in 2008 and 2009. Moreover, we live in an age of essentially universal suffrage. And in the 18th century, what those colonists were struggling for was for the right of men, white men who owned property, to have a role in their own government. That's a very small percentage of the population today. And so there's just the analogy is completely cockamamie.
Right, so
I mean, there's a spirit to it that makes sense. But by any metric, you can't argue that we live in an age without representation today.
What about the other really common claim that the U.S. was founded on the basis of Christianity? You've had a number of prominent conservatives making that point lately, that the U.S. was intended by the Founding Fathers to be a Christian nation.
A lot of these claims are years in coming. There's a long backstory behind each of these claims. There are a couple more pieces of it. I mean, we could maybe identify four. So one is this notion of taxation without representation. The other is a Christian nation. The third would be that the revolution was fought to establish free markets. It's a common claim that's made by the far right. And the fourth would be that the Founding Fathers established the Constitution as a kind of holy writ, as a kind of revealed religion that was kind of incorruptible. Each of these claims has antecedents in American history. There have been other times and places where, for political reasons, people have put forth these arguments. They simply do not accord with the archival evidence when you study the 18th century and look at the lives of ordinary people in particular. And part of the distortion is this group of people to whom we confine all of our discussions. So we talk about the Founding Fathers. Well, the Founding Fathers is itself, that phrase was coined by Warren Harding, you know, in 1921, when he was trying to sort of suggest that he was the next founding father, that his presidency was divinely inspired. So even sort of the invention of the idea that there is this small set of people who have this particular political authority and historical authority that trumps anything that anyone else who ever lived in the 18th century had to say is itself a political argument.
Right. I mean, didn't Tom Paine say religion, he thought, was something to the effect that religion was a bad idea?
Yeah, I mean, there's this weird sloppiness. You know, if Paine said something that's useful to your political argument, people will quote Paine, and people on the far right will quote Paine, you know, often only really quoting from Common Sense, which he wrote in 1776. But of course, Common Sense was the first in what Paine considered really a trilogy of books, going on to write The Rights of Man and The Age of Reason. And The Age of Reason is an extended argument against organized and institutional religion of any kind. Paine, you know, famously said, "My own mind is my own church." I mean, he just completely opposed organized religion in any form and thought that an established religion and a relationship between the church and the state was the greatest form of all tyranny. And Jefferson believed this too. There's a beautiful passage in Jefferson's first inaugural address where, having gained the presidential office after a campaign in which Adams supporters said the choice at the ballot box was between Jefferson and no God, or God and John Adams, you know, Jefferson got up there and said, you know, we have gained nothing if we have given up religious despotism for political despotism that is equally as absolute.
And they debated this amongst themselves. Didn't John Adams then in turn sort of accuse Thomas Jefferson of being an atheist?
Yeah, although, you know, John Adams' own views on religion were very complicated. I mean, he actually thought that Christianity was necessary to maintain morality, but he, in some deep way, didn't have a kind of belief in it that, say, later evangelicals would have in it. I mean, the point that you're getting at here, which is very hard for people to necessarily hold in their heads in the kind of soundbite culture, but the 18th century was an age of tremendous intellectual ferment, right? I mean, people are coming up with whole new ways of thinking about the relationship between people and their rulers, really wrestling in a way that hadn't been wrestled with since, you know, the great philosophical debates of antiquity. People really deeply, profoundly wondering, how do we govern ourselves and one another, and what are the rights that we have as human beings? So there's nothing but disagreement. There can be no great debate without a tremendous amount of disagreement. And what we have now, of course, in this weird, freaky bumper sticker culture that we live in, like, if you think about what Google does, it's like a decontextualizing machine. Like, if you wanted to invent something that could take anything that you or I say out of context, we would invent Google. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to Google Jefferson and God or Adams and God, you can find all kinds of positions, all kinds of little snippets to support one or another position.
Right, yeah.
And if you're just, you know, posting something, blogging something, screaming something on, you know, on television, you can say, you could say you have the authority of the founding fathers to make this claim, but it's completely taken out of context. And it's the fabric of that debate, of decades of political debate, where, you know, individuals change their minds. It's not just that Jefferson and Adams disagree with one another. They change their minds over the course of their lives. These are these brilliant intellectuals. Of course they change their minds about things.
Well, and the quote-unquote founding fathers are hardly a monolith. But there's one of the really interesting points to me that you make in your book is that there's a long history in America of laying claim to various and sundry of the founding fathers, but there's something different about what the Tea Party has been doing, that there's, I think what you said is that there's something sort of religious about the way they refer to the founding fathers.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about what I call historical fundamentalism, and that's the one element of the Tea Party that troubles me. I mean, I think it really does need to be said again and again and again that most people who have been swept up in this political movement are upset about the economy, they're worried about the debt, they have all kinds of, you know, very ordinary and sympathetic political concerns, and they're expressing their political views publicly, and, you know, nothing is better, right? That's what we're here for. That's what we do. We need to debate, and we need to exercise our right to political speech. What's troubling to me is the way in which some of the elevation of this very narrow and contorted view of the 18th century to a kind of national scripture, and especially the use of the Constitution in American political life by people on the far right, is kind of an end run around the church-state separation issue. If you make history a religion, then you can bring religion into the schools. If you make history your religion, then you can bring your religion into politics. And that really troubles me. So that when people would say, you could watch on Fox News people kind of having an argument about, say, the Health Care Reform Act, which, you know, you and I might disagree about the Health Care Reform Act. We could get ourselves blue in the face arguing about it, and nothing would be more American and nothing would be more democratic than for us to disagree about it. And so long as we're having this debate and we're bringing different evidence into it and our political advantages and our own experiences, we're having a healthy and important debate. But the minute I say, you know what, I think it is unconstitutional, and then we're going to have a debate about whether it's unconstitutional. That's also fine. But then if I proclaim to you that the Constitution was essentially written by God and that the Founding Fathers were divinely inspired and that the Constitution amounts to a revealed religion, then everything that you say when you disagree with me I view as a kind of heresy. And then my contempt for your belief is a kind of sickening and destabilizing and disequilibrizing force in our conversation. And that, I think, is, you know, on the margins of this movement, the kind of thing that you see, and that really does trouble me.
And I guess what I'm wondering is why the desire to treat the Constitution as a document of a revealed religion. I mean, it suggests there's some hunger for a kind of pure and stable truth.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and a very understandable one, right? Like, we are, as a people, a story. We don't really have a common history or common language, common ethnicity. We do not share a common religion. We share an idea. We share this faith in our system of government and the ideas and the ideals that were indeed established in the 18th century. For me, that idea is the idea of the constant struggle to realize the promise of those ideas. I mean, I don't think that the promise of the revolution was realized in the 18th century. I don't think it has been realized yet. What I cherish as an American is the struggle to realize that promise of equality.
Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University and the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. She spoke with N. Strange Champs.